You're listening to Through the Funnel, where we demystify Chinese medicine. I'm your host, Mallory Jaimo, and this is episode number 5. Hi, welcome. Today, I am joined by my herbal medicine instructor and once clinic supervisor, Anne Woolman. Anne, thank you so much for joining me today.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Before we get started on our topic of Chinese herbal medicine, I want to share a bit more about you with our audience. So Anne is a seasoned diplomat of Chinese medicine, which makes her a licensed acupuncturist and herbalist. She's been in the field since 1996, when she graduated from the Colorado School of TCM, and moved to Asheville in 2004, where she currently resides and teaches at My Alumni Taoist Traditions. Anne is an herbal instructor for Taoist Traditions master's program and postgraduate studies. She specializes in teaching the history of Chinese medicine and has had a love for Asian studies and philosophy and culture since she was in eighth grade. And also treats patients at the Chinese Acupuncture and Herbology Clinic in Asheville, North Carolina, where she specializes in women's health, internal medicine, and pain management. And thank you again for joining with me today. I just love your background. And let's just jump in with a very basic, easy question. Tell me what your favorite thing is about Chinese medicine and what you love the most about it.
I think my favorite thing about the practice of Chinese medicine is that most of the time I can be helpful to people. Mm-hmm. Not always miraculously, but sometimes I feel like the efficacy of Chinese medicine is extremely high. Yes. And that is, to me, the most gratifying thing. I find it to be a modality that has a tremendous amount of application and helpfulness to patients, and is a very good adjunct to Western medicine or companion to Western medicine, because it's different enough and yet developed enough to be really effective. So it has a standalone value and it has integrative value both. It also has an incredibly long history and tradition, which is something that I'm particularly interested in, and I'm sure we'll dive more deeply into during our discussion, making it a very rational system, a very rational choice, and yet on the not other side of rationality, but connected to rationality, it's also extremely holistic, genuinely holistic, and genuinely spiritually oriented. So it provides a great framework to be helpful to people. And I don't think anyone can ask for anything more in a career than to do something that is endlessly interesting and helpful to folks.
Wonderful. Much more than I had expected. And I often will say to patients that it is a complete system of care, focusing on the physical body, the mental, emotional, the spiritual. And then within often that same conversation, I'll say in examples, you know, Western and Eastern Chinese medicine physiology is pretty much the same. Chinese medicine gets a little bit more detailed, I think, in a way, and more with the movement of resources going into the body. But it's not like it's a big, weird mystery. And when people hear that integration, they feel more connected to it because it is foreign and it is distant to some people.
Yeah, I think that that's really true. Exactly. That it has this connectedness that provides an integrated whole. And again, in my teaching, I'm particularly interested in the history and the continuity of thought that occurs in Chinese medicine. Because when I encounter patients, many of them come, they don't know much about Chinese medicine, as you've just said, same, I'm sure, for you. And so they come with this kind of almost naive excitement. They believe that it works. because it's so old. I hear that over and over again, right? That they say, I'm here because I know acupuncture works. They typically know more about acupuncture than they do herbal medicine. And that's because it's old. And yet they don't really know how old. They don't really have any detail on what makes it work and why would they? But it makes a practitioner feel, or it has made me feel over the years, like it's my responsibility to understand as much of the rationale and the development of Chinese medicine as possible, and to be able to articulate what it is that I'm doing with them and for them and why, and where those strategies, those techniques, those point combinations, formulas are rooted in documented anecdotal, primarily, and we can talk about research, evidence. Mm-hmm. So it really is a science and an art, and it has, again, a very, very mappable and understandable continuity throughout time. And it has also the potential that is unfolding for an amazing future.
So when a new patient comes in and they say that to you, where do you start?
I usually feel out how deeply they want to delve into that discussion. And some people will have pretty detailed discussions about why I'm taking a particular approach. And I've never had anyone who wasn't interested in what I was saying, much to my surprise. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are, of course, some people who come in and they have shoulder pain and they just want their shoulder pain fixed. But most people really come in with a genuine kind of curiosity and level of engagement with the modality. And that provides a window really to talk about whatever it is that they're interested in. Mm-hmm. So I like to talk about what they like me to talk about, what I'm thinking, what I'm doing. Of course, some of that would involve concepts of the movement of qi. Some of that would involve concepts regarding the meridians themselves, what they are, how they're mappable, how understanding of the meridians has developed. For some people, it's more spiritually oriented. Sometimes mm-hmm. we'll talk about some of the classical spiritual texts that are connected to Chinese medicine, and many folks are very interested in those kinds of Eastern concepts of mind-body connection. So this enables you to have a language and a kind of depth to those discussions that I think people really appreciate and constantly surprise me by how much they appreciate them.
Yeah, so I talked about the simplicity of treatment and diagnosis and how Chinese medicine views hot and cold. And as a discussion of the eight principles in a previous podcast, and I think it's episode one, if people want to go back and check that out. But so one of the things that I gave an example to was the shoulder pain and it being potentially diagnosed as that wind, cold, damp. So let's take a look at that. If someone comes in and they want to know more, are you going to jump right into the treatment of cold disorders and the history of that and how Chinese medicine looks at it? Or would you, again, like you're saying, each patient is going to depend on where you go with your conversation. But let's just say I'm coming in for shoulder pain and I don't know too much about Chinese medicine. Where would you take me if I want to know why this is happening and why treating it with ice and cold isn't working for me and it's actually getting worse?
Okay, so I can certainly, I think maybe by answering those questions, I can demonstrate how I would approach it. So I would say that you've made a really good choice in coming to acupuncture to treat shoulder pain. And as you've heard and read, it's very effective for pain. So, and I would say some of the things I've already said, that Chinese medicine has this long and very continuous sort of history of treating pain. And the basic concept in treating pain, which is linked to the basic concepts of the meridians, is that, quote unquote, where there is pain, there is stagnation. You probably remember me talking about that quote, right? So that concept that there is some type of blockage in the circulation, to use a Western word, or the movement, to use perhaps a more Chinese medicine word, of qi and blood through the meridian system is blocked. And blockages can occur for a whole variety of reasons. An obvious one would be trauma. So if I, you know, hit you in the shoulder and you develop a big swelling and bruise and stiffness, right, let that get stiff, you can see that that bruise shows that the blood is not circulating properly. It's ruptured out of the vessel, its normal pathways or vessels. And certainly that kind of stiffness or sort of splinting, maybe that's a more Western concept that occurs, could be called stagnation. So an obvious visible, you know, something we've all experienced, we've all fallen down and injured ourselves. But stagnation also has kind of a spiritual conceptual rooting in that we can get blocked for spiritual reasons even.
Stuck. Yeah.
We can get stuck, right? So we know that pathology, disease, discomfort has potentially this issue with stagnation or blockage. And again, you can expound upon that. So I'll often talk about how metaphoric the language of Chinese medicine is, right? That so we may not have literal cold, and we may actually, I had a particular case, this is many, many years ago, of a man who came to me what he thought was arthritis in his knees. He was I was living in Colorado at the time. He was a mechanic, and his job was to go to people's houses and fix their cars outside. And he had spent, you know, years basically leaning against cars. He had a particular posture where his knees would be up against the cars. It was cold in the winter and he'd be working on people's cars. What seemed like to him very suddenly, he started having excruciating, characteristic of cold, fixed, characteristic of cold, knee pain. And he went to his doctor, and his doctor said, oh, you have osteoarthritis, and had started him taking NSAIDs. So he took NSAIDs for a long period of time, and then developed stomach problems, of course, from the NSAIDs, because they're challenging in that way. So with him, it was the perfect opportunity to discuss the concept of cold. So cold, clearly this was a quote-unquote cold invasion. I used lots of moxibustion and lots of heating techniques. And that was one of those, back to our very first sentence, practically kind of miracle cures, because the diagnosis was so, so clear. Mm-hmm. That also links with what I was talking about earlier, which is really trying to understand my approach and why I'm taking it. Mm-hmm. So to continue that conversation with you, I would say, so now we have this basic understanding that stagnation causes pain or discomfort, especially channel pain, because the blockage of qi and blood flow through the channels is painful. Cold causes extreme pain because it stops movement. And that's why we use ice in Western medicine. We use ice to drive blood circulation away in an acute trauma. Mm-hmm. But that is potentially pathological, mm-hmm. because once healing needs to occur, we need to stimulate circulation. And that's what acupuncture does. Mm-hmm. So if they're really interested in delving deep into the history, which is my passion, then I would potentially go into the Han Dynasty bias against cold, mm-hmm. and the elemental kind of factors that are so important in the history of Chinese medicine. Again, discussing both the more literal kinds of concepts or definitions, as well as the more esoteric and metaphoric ones.
So which school of thought does where there is pain, there is stagnation come from?
I would say that dates all the way back to the Neijing. So we know that, right? We know that wind heralds 1,000 diseases, and yeah. Those 1,000 diseases. So the concept of cold and stagnation causing pain and discomfort goes back to that kind of golden era, what we would say, of writing, right? Mm-hmm. The earliest written records of Chinese medicine date back to the Han Dynasty, which is about the year 220 ACE. Now we say after Common Era, right? So that is kind of a golden age of writing, where we see the Shang Han Lun. We see the major texts being dated to that time frame. Mm-hmm. Then Chinese medicine, again, in a very continuous and very very understandable and readable way, builds conceptually. So by the Tang Dynasty, we're talking more about dampness. Mm-hmm. And the concept of what we would diagnose your shoulder pain as, which is B, obstruction, again, obstruction in the channels, develops along with these concepts. And so by the time we get to modern TCM, we call that a wind, cold, damp, B obstruction pattern.
And where does moxibustion come in within the history? Because for those that don't know, and you can certainly elaborate, but moxibustion is an herb that we roll into kind of like a cigar. There's more processing that goes along with it, but that's the end result. And then we light it and take it above the skin about an inch or 2 inches to then warm the body and create that warmth, which then creates the movement to dispel and mm-hmm. expel the cold. So getting a little into the herbal medicine side, at what point in history did moxibustion come in? And then also, how are you using the moxibustion internally, externally?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I haven't studied the history of moxibustion in depth, but my understanding is that it developed alongside concepts of acupuncture. So there's a classic of acupuncture and moxibustion, which I believe would probably also date back to the Han Dynasty. But we'd have to look at when it was actually written. They developed together. And the herb that you're using in moxibustion is Artemisia vulgaris. I will say that even prior to written records, when tombs have been excavated, so really when we go back all the way to this idea that Chinese medicine is so old, what we believe is that it could be 5,000 years old. So I'm talking about written 2,000 years, but there are tombs that have been excavated, you probably know this, where they have found mummified bodies, for example, that have the meridians drawn on them. Mm-hmm. Well, in one of these archaeological settings, they found a packet that contained huopo, magnolia bark, was preserved in this packet. So we believe that herbal medicine was being used, of course, and this just makes sense, was being used by these very early people who were not yet writing, but were starting to leave written evidence in the form of divination markings on tortoise shells and on bones. Mm-hmm. So there's also this whole archaeological study of Chinese medicine. Mm-hmm. So moxibustion, I believe, is as old as acupuncture is. It would be fun to go back and really study that in depth. But the concept with moxibustion is that Artemisia vulgaris has this particular property that it's able to penetrate the channels. It's able to go into the channels and warm the channels. It's in and go into the body. And if you're working with the primary channels, even potentially because the primary channels connect the interior terrain of the body to the exterior, it's possible that by using moxibustion on certain points, you're potentially affecting the organs as well. So we still, again, practice that way and incorporate that concept into our practice because this moxibustion has this very special kind of property of penetration. Now, interestingly, if you travel throughout Asia, you will see different types of moxibustion, some of which we don't use here anymore. So, for example, in Tibet and Nepal, I saw tools that where they would use scarring moxa. So they would take like a bronze tool, often a religious symbol, perhaps like a Buddhist dorje or something, and they would scar on the body. They would burn the body. So the use of heat, and we could say in that case cauterization, even would also be, you know, very, very traditional. But the bias against cold does go back to the Han Dynasty when we identified, where Chinese medicine identified these climactic factors as being causes of disease. And that disease factor involves blockage. Absolutely.
And Chinese medicine does a really great, an amazing job at organizing itself. And so we know within the Materia Medica that artemisia and mugwort, and then I do kind of want to, there are a couple places where I'm like, ooh, we could go there too, but talk a little about magnolia and popo. So where are they found in the materia medica that we use today? And the materia medica too, maybe you can provide some information on the history of that and when it was written, and talk to us a little bit about the categories of those herbs, specifically the artemisia and the magnolia.
Mm-hmm. So the earliest materia medica that we refer to is the Shenon Bensao, which again dates back to the Han Dynasty, which we would say was like the, again, I keep saying the golden era of Chinese medicine. And it contained 350, I believe, herbs in it and discussed their properties. So if we say, well, the Chinese medicine begins in a way in written form in terms of materia medica, and we'll define a materia medica as a collection of medicinal substances and a description of those medicinal substances, mm-hmm. which would be different than, but linked to a botanical text or a collection of plants. So there's obviously a connection, but here we're really looking at medicinal substances. And one thing that's interesting about Chinese herbal medicine is that you can even have multiple substances that will be called the same herb. Mm. So it's very important to understand that this is not a botanical concept. Mm. This is a concept of function. So these substances perform this function. And the way that the substances are organized changes throughout time and is reflective of, and I'm not going to go too deeply into this because that's way nerding out, which I can do, but basically changes over time based on concepts of disease and pathology and expands in a certain way. You would think about an expanding materia medica. So the Shenon Bensao begins with 350 herbs. Then by the time we're in the 1100s, we have Li Zhizhen's, I think it's the 1100s, the Bensao Gengmu, which has many, many, many more substances. I don't want to quote a number and be wrong. And now if we go fast forward into present day, we use a materia medica across the board. Chinese medicine students and practitioners use Benski. And the way that Benski organizes the materia medica is unique to modern Chinese medicine. So you could have a materia medica that is organized by grades of herbs, like the Shenon Bensao, where herbs were organized by being higher grade, low, middle grade, or lower grade, meaning how they healed the body. Were they emergency cures? Were they kind of middle grade supportive herbs, or are they longevity, health promoting, eternal life promoting? Mm-hmm. Again, fast forward through time, each materia medica is going to be organized in relation to the person or group of people who are writing it and what their concepts of disease are and how they would find organization most beneficial. Mm-hmm. So in order to understand how we use the materia medica now, we have to understand something about TCM. And probably since you're doing a series, you've talked a little bit about diagnosis mm-hmm. and pattern differentiation, sounds mm-hmm. like. Mm-hmm. So you've talked about how Chinese medicine diagnoses and names a pattern mm-hmm. that's related to a particular organ system. That pattern differentiation concept also, of course, develops over time and becomes codified in TCM. Mm-hmm. So what Benski has done is he's compiled as much information about a specific substance as he can, and he's basically listing all of the functions that are a compilation as those herbs are used in formulas, as well as they're found in older materia medicas. And he's organized it by category. And the categories are related to TCM categories.
And so which categories?
Complex.
Yeah, yeah. And complex. That's just such, like, I'm not showing it in my face, but it's like listening to you talk, my brain is like, whoa, what a science and what a process of building this medicine, and you know, looking back even further, I know we can say that they received a lot of this information in the very beginning from downloads from the heavens. And so, you know, that's always happening. It's always evolving in that matter, not just scientifically. But so getting back to the mugwort and the hopo, so what categories do those fall in under Benski? Where are we going to find those?
We're going to find the hopo under regulate chi.
Okay. Right?
It descends the chi.
Okay.
So regulating chi typically means moving chi.
Yep.
That's right. Regulating and moving, again, we're talking about Chinese medicine theory. So it's going to descend the chi. Now, another one person I respect very much, which is Julianne Nugent Head.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you talked about the Nugent Heads, but she makes a very strong argument for going back again to the Neijing, back to the Han Dynasty, and looking at the concepts of taste, flavor, and nature. Yeah. So the idea of herbs having particular characteristics, or what is called the qi of the herb, is a very classical perspective. And she's made an argument that the materia medica is not properly organized by Benski, meaning it should not be organized by pattern, essentially, or by associated patterns, right? In a TCM way, it should be organized by taste, flavor, and nature. So hot herbs should all be together. Cold herbs should all be together. Herbs that are acrid and therefore moving, mm-hmm, should be together. So the qi of the herb is going to influence the dynamics and the energetics of the herb. Mm-hmm. So taste, flavor, and nature. So you can imagine that cold herbs are going to clear heat. They're going to counteract heat. They're going to stop movement, potentially. We talked about that. Whereas hot herbs are going to counteract cold or blockage. They're going to move, perhaps. Acrid, spicy herbs are particularly moving. So when they engage the sensory orifices, exactly. Mm-hmm. So you go like that. So if mm-hmm. you eat, wasabi is a good example. You eat wasabi and your eyes start watering and you start tearing and your mouth is, it's everything.
Not for me. Yeah.
Right. But the movement is up and out.
Yep.
Right. Sour herbs restrain. So the idea is that when you taste a sour herb, right, your energy goes in. So we restrain perhaps with sour herbs. Mm-hmm. So the taste, flavor, and nature of the herbs have correspondence with early Chinese medicine concepts. At the very beginning, you talked about the simplicity of Chinese medicine. So if we say that the beginning is yin and yang, and from yin and yang sprouts, lack of a better word, a more complex differentiation or distinction. So we go from just yin and yang, hot, cold, up, down, in, out, you know, dark, light, soft, hard, right? To a more complex differentiation. This is very, very embedded in Eastern philosophy. The one begets the two begets the thousand things. Mm-hmm. So the herbs have an affinity for the elements, the five elements. They have, mm-hmm, they start to have an affinity or a connection as we move throughout time to the specific channel systems. That actually comes quite late, which is interesting. They're not entering a specific channel for quite a while in Chinese medicine thinking. Mm-hmm. But now in modern times, we're bringing forward all of those understandings and we're trying to organize them in a way that is most useful for teaching and practicing. And that's what the Benski Materia Medica does. So it's organized basically by treatment strategies, mm-hmm, that are related to TCM patterns and concepts.
Mm-hmm. And you've mentioned patterns a couple times, so I want to talk a little bit about that. But I think there were, so you quickly went over three of the flavors. So, and then there was talk a little bit about the sweet flavor, and then skipping
salty.
My line.
Salty.
That's salty. Okay. Yeah.
Salty, sweet, acrid. So there's salty, there's sweet, there's acrid, there's bitter, there's bland, which comes a little bit later. Bland is kind of a neutral flavor. So sweet herbs are associated with the earth element. Mm-hmm. Which comes to be associated with the spleen organ, mm-hmm. which of course is associated with digestion and is in the middle. So the sweet flavor nourishes and it moistens. Mm-hmm. When there's too much sweetness, it creates dampness. Mm-hmm. So all of the flavors ideally are balanced. That doesn't mean that they're equal. Mm-hmm. Right, balance is not equal. So you may require something different, for example, than I require in order to be healthy. We're in different stages of our lives. We have different constitutions and different natures. We live in different climates. Mm-hmm. So there's no constant here, right? So the art of Chinese medicine is assessing for your patient what's going to be most beneficial to their situation. And what you see in terms of Chinese medicine theory is out of balance. Mm-hmm. So anyway, the sweet flavor, it stabilizes, not in the sense of restraining, but it does, it helps to nourish and center the spleen. But again, it generates moisture as well, right? And we know eating too much sugar, for example, will create phlegm. And lots of patients experience that. Now, when you have a lot of dampness, your body will respond with heat to put out that dampness. And so it's likely that from a Chinese medicine perspective, some of the Western concept of inflammation is related to that. People make a very direct correlation between eating too much sugar and feeling joint pain and inflammation. That's because that dampness gets produced, and then the body basically creates heat to try to counterbalance that dampness, and you get often inflammatory pain, because all of those factors can be potentially stagnating. Right, because and remember, pain. Right, so disease or pain is caused by stagnation. The salty flavor also restrains. Right, it kind of you get kind of dry. It basically, in a way, water follows salt, so it can dry out, but it can moisten by guiding the fluids in a certain direction. Something that most people know about is taking, for example, salt as a laxative. Like mineral salt, Epsom salt, so basically that's drawing fluid into the bowels. So salt can help purge the bowels. It has a downward function, and that dates back again to the Han Dynasty. The salty flavor is associated with the kidneys and with the bones. It goes deep. We talked about acrid or spicy. Acrid, spicy, and pungent kind of go together. Talked about bitter. The bitter flavor goes down, it enters the heart meridian, and it drains heat or fire. So a good example of a bitter substance that we can see operating that way is coffee. Mm-hmm. When people drink coffee, they're drinking a bitter, or beer. Beer is also bitter. Mm-hmm. So if you drink coffee or beer and you urinate a lot, and you notice that your urine, especially I think with coffee, becomes yellow, it's because that bitter flavor is draining that heat out via the urinary system. So this is a very experiential kind of thing. You can experience the taste of sour. Sour astringes, restrains, makes you pucker up, holds in. It's associated with the liver. It's associated with the tendons. You can experience, again, that spicy up and out movement. You can experience that cold and bitter downward. It doesn't have to be cold, but typically you combine it with the bitter herbs are often cold to drain heat down and out through the urine or through the bowels because heat rises. So you can see there's this elemental kind of very understandable, very coherent, very consistent ideas in Chinese medicine that make the diagnosis in some ways, if you let go of being intimidated by it, very simple.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was going to mention that even though our discussion started with herbal medicine, these tastes and flavors and temperatures also are directly related to, which he talks about too, food. Absolutely. And so using food as a way to experiment with these different flavors, and that's exactly what they did hundreds of thousands of years ago, is they started to just taste plants and see what it did to their tongue, their mouth. They put Absolutely. It on their skin and really were scientists experimenting Absolutely. With our natural elements. And I have to tell you, I remember being in class and you're so encouraging, but it wasn't until I was probably in practice for at least 5 years where I felt comfortable, but I really started to experiment with a lot of different herbs, taking them in low volumes and high volumes. And within like this past year, I just started to take in a little bit of salt, just pinches of salt. And it was interesting. The first few times that I did it, I would get just a ball of phlegm in my throat. And so
it would be drawn.
Yeah. And I must have had some congestion, so much so that I was able to bring it to the surface and spit it out. And then my brain went to, okay, what do I need that's a little acrid and moving that's going to help my body to then disperse this? So seeing the transition of the use of these herbs and even plants, I think at the time too, I probably bought some radishes and started eating raw red radishes, which people know are is often very spicy. So
Absolutely.
This applies to so many different elements of what we have access to, not just herbal medicine. Going back to, so you've mentioned patterns quite a bit, which I haven't talked about too much in previous episodes, but of our diagnosis of the shoulder, so you talked a little bit about the B obstruction and the cold, how would you put that into a pattern diagnosis? And then maybe talking about some of the herbs that you would use there too, either topically or internally.
Okay. Before that, I was looking to see if I could get a good definition of science, because I like that you talk about Chinese medicine as a science. I think it's unfortunate that we equate science so much with the scientific method, which of course in ancient China was not a concept, and double blind placebo based testing was not a concept. So now if we go into modern Chinese medicine, we see so many studies that are starting to occur, and as you know, there are ways now of doing double blind placebo based testing with acupuncture because they're sham needles. Mm-hmm. So we're starting to see lots and lots and lots of Western scientific method applied to Chinese medicine. But again, I don't want to be distracted by the computer to get a definition of science.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Well, okay.
Honestly, I think of science, well, you kind of look around if you want, but I'll just throw my opinion in there. I think of science as experimentation. And anything where you're going to take one substance and one plus one becomes two. So you can always add to your substance to then move into the science of chemistry and the interaction of the two. And it's funny, I don't know why I want to say this, but I want to say it. Like, I remember being in clinic with you too, and me wanting to pull out my phone to add up the grams of the herbal formula. And you said, no, like this is simple, right? It's just like threes, sixes, and nines or something. And we're adding up these formulas. And when I sit with some patients, we're talking about math or something. And I'll say to them, I'm really not a mathematician. I'm a scientist. And I can see their face change. And they, you know, similar to probably expressions that you get, they want to know more of what that means. And usually what I'll say is, I just experiment and I want to know how I relate to them, whether it's herbs or plants or seasonal changes, because how classical Chinese medicine looks at treatment and disease and the human is as an individual, which goes back to what you were saying before, in that classical Chinese medicine isn't going to treat me the same way it's going to treat you, even if we have the same exact presentation of a disease or of, you know, just a pathogen, something that's causing discomfort in the body. And so anyway, on and on.
You're so brilliant. Here's the definition of science. It's exactly what you said. The systematic study of structure and behavior of the physical and natural world through observation. It's exactly what you said. Experimentation. Exactly what you said. And testing of theories against the evidence obtained. Mm-hmm. The archaic definition is knowledge of any kind. Mm-hmm. So, and to some extent, of course, we are looking at an archaic time when we go back 2,000 years. So the key here is that Chinese medicine is a science. It doesn't fit the narrow, I think, I don't want to put words in anyone's mouth, but the relatively focused on double-blind placebo-based testing model of Western medicine historically, but it certainly is moving in that direction. So it has, again, this wonderful theoretical foundation in science. It is truly both an art and a science. So, okay, now back, I want to answer your question too.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was going to take a minute to be a little smarty, but it was, you know, what they're doing now is they're taking the theories of the science and trying to prove those, when we know as practitioners that that's not really necessary. But to the structured form of the Western way, to have it documented and to have it very linear, and, you know, a lot of the studies that I've come across lately, which is a very Western way, it's like they'll pick apart one herb. So turmeric's really famous now, and everybody's hot for turmeric. Right. And so they're looking at less, which you kind of talked about earlier, at they're looking more at the botanical than they are looking at it as a plant and a whole substance. And
they're looking at it and the pharmacology of it. Absolutely.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I think that the key is that there's validity to all of it.
Yes.
And now we're digressing, and I promise we can come back to the obstruction and shoulder pain. But okay. I think that's really important to recognize that there's validity to all of it. And I mean, over a long period of time of practicing, one goes through many questioning phases and kind of crises. And one of the things that I found very lacking in my education was a distinction between what is clinically effective and what is probably not as clinically effective. So the material was often presented in this like whole. And that's part of the concern with TCM, which is the structure of Chinese medicine that has come out of communist China. It's the codification of Chinese medicine that is based on the entire history of Chinese medicine, but it's an attempt to simplify and codify it. And when it's presented to students, it's often presented just in this, like, this is true and it's all true and it all works and it's all the same. And then when you get out into practice and you realize that just because somebody told you that it was part of this codification, you're not having success with it because you don't understand why it is that you're employing this strategy.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? So it takes a long, long, long time to go back and say, okay, I need to understand where this information came from, where this strategy came from. Where does the strategy of releasing the exterior when there's an external pathogenic factor come from? And why should I follow these protocols unless I understand them? So there's a tremendous amount of depth to understanding what you're doing and why you're doing it. And that's what makes really for the richness and makes for your ability to say with such conviction that it's effective, mm-hmm. which is, I think, a really beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the richness of it and your experience as someone who's been in the medicine for a longer period of time than I have, seeing the same thing present in different ways. And maybe, you know, I know I've done this, trying one thing that I did before and getting ish results, but then needing to shift things again for the individual and really use that customization of just because someone has shoulder pain and it's chronic doesn't mean that doing the same points, doing the same steps in treatment is going to result in healing like it did for person B that we might have seen a couple days ago or a couple weeks ago. Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk a little bit about just pattern and give our audience some insight into that word, since it was mentioned quite a few times in our conversation?
Sure. So pattern differentiation develops over time. All the Chinese medicine concepts develop over time, but it's a languaging of how one describes pathology in Chinese mm-hmm. medicine. Mm-hmm. So the organ systems are discussed in terms of energetic and physical dynamics of each organ system. So the liver system, for example, is in charge of spreading the qi and blood through the body. That's one of the main characteristics or the main functions of the liver. So liver patterns that involve stagnation of the liver. Again, the liver spreads. It's related to the wood element. You can imagine the branches of a tree. It's related to the spring season when we're quite expansive and outward. There's a lot of flow in terms of people are excited to get outside. Mm-hmm. So when the liver is blocked in Chinese medicine, pattern differentiation, we might call that qi stagnation. Mm-hmm. That's going to be related, of course, to the liver primary channel that connects the liver organ with the exterior terrain of the body via a mapped meridian, right? That has a beginning and an end and a connection. So the meridian system itself is essentially a map of the body, right? We call it the Jing Lo, which is the channels and collaterals. It's what moves the qi through the body in a very predictable and patterned way. Mm-hmm. So we're going to see, for example, pain in the costal region, tightness with liver qi stagnation, because the liver channel goes through the costal region. So we could take all the organs and discuss their function in Chinese medicine and how pathology, when it affects that particular organ and perhaps that channel, although you can have channel problems without having organ problems, because there are tendinosinew meridians that run superficially on the body that don't connect the organ, that don't go to the organ. So back to our earlier example of if I hit you in the arm and it hurts, I may not have had any effect on the large intestine, even though I've hit the large intestine channel. That could be a sinew meridian issue, right? But the pattern differentiation has to do with the internal organs as well. So we say as well as the channels. And again, this conceptually develops over time. So we have a concepts of the idea of deficiency. We have the idea of stagnation, and we name those patterns in diagnostic language. So we might say there is the pathology occurring is one of liver qi stagnation. The flow of qi through the liver system is blocked. Or we might say, since the liver stores and holds the blood and it governs the blood and it's a yin organ, we can talk about the distinction between yin and yang. If yin is deficient, and or blood is deficient, then we might see dryness manifesting mm-hmm. along the liver channel. So we might see dry eyes. Mm-hmm. It's said that the nails open to the liver. So we have associations of physical tissue. We have with each of the channels and organs, right? So we might see dry nails because the liver is associated with the nails, like not getting enough blood flow. So we would name that in our pattern differentiation as liver yin or blood deficiency. Mm-hmm. So the pattern differentiation is a codified, structured languaging for diagnosis that relates to the organs and to the primary channels primarily, and to the substances that are key for physiology and pathology in Chinese medicine.
Yep. And then to take it a little further, so if someone is experiencing that liver blood deficiency, what flavors would you use to treat them with, either herbs or food?
That's such a great, I love that question. You're a great interviewer. Okay. So that's great. So you would use, you might use the sour flavor. That would be the most obvious answer, because since I told you earlier that sour was associated with the liver. Yep. And your purpose in doing that would be to restrain those fluids, right? To kind of hold those fluids in so that they don't get wasted, or we don't have a loss of fluids. So we'll combine flavors, and this is going to be very key and everything goes back to earlier things that we've said. The herbs are rarely to never used alone. Mm-hmm. So we have to combine flavors. So one flavor that comes right to mind would be sour. So we might use an herb like baishao or white peony, mm-hmm. which it nourishes liver blood and has a sour quality to it. If you taste it, you'll taste some sour. Mm-hmm. The other flavor we might want to use is sweet, mm-hmm. right? Because sweet generates fluids, and yin is fluid. So yin and yang describe a relationship to one another, where yin is fluid or wet, and yang is dry, mm-hmm. right? So moisture is yin. Dryness is yang, essentially. So if we have blood deficiency or yin deficiency, we have a lack of that moist substantive quality in the body. So we might need some sweetness to nourish the fluid and generate the fluid. And we're talking about that direct experience of maybe eating too much sugar and then feeling kind of phlegmy, right? That's very common. One could certainly experience that. We can go on and on. We might need to add a little bit of acrid and spicy herbs, but not too much, because when we have a lot of sweetness and a lot of sourness, we have lack of movement, and we have this, right, this moisture that's kind of not moving very well. And anytime we have lack of movement, we have potential for pathology. So we have to balance our formula, right, with a little bit of an herb that's going to help to disperse that nourishment that we're producing or encouraging. So again, our formulas are typically in some ways very simple if we go back to these basic concepts, but they are complex in that we are combining flavors together. We're combining substances together. And each school of thought throughout time has described different treatment strategies and different concepts of how we combine herbs together to treat pathology as it was being described and seen at the time.
Yeah, and I want to mention too that the sweet flavor that we often find in Chinese medicine is licorice, which is very common, and then also, or honey fried licorice. So just the use of natural substances like honey and maple syrup.
Dates, right?
Dates. Yeah, the jujus. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we're even Chinese medicine, and you talked about this before, in that they're known as substances, a collection of substances. So that includes food, which these past two that we just talked about are, and then also, of course, plants, and anywhere from the flower of the plant, the root of the plant, the bark, the stem.
Rhizome, exactly. Twigs, the bark, absolutely the flowers, the rhizomes, the flower before it manifests itself while it still has
bloom,
the most potential, right? It still has that kind of potential for opening up. Yes, absolutely. Yes. And so maybe thinking about diet, one basic dietary concept might be the use of rice, mm-hmm. which is sweet and moistening. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And very supportive of digestion, very nourishing, very easy to digest potentially, but can also kind of bog people down a little bit, right? We know grains of any kind, some can make people feel kind of heavy. So too much of that sweet flavor, again, is going to be too moistening, create dampness, and create stagnation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I need to look into this, but you're reminding me about how I could not eat sweet potatoes. They just were too heavy. They bogged me down. I'd feel slow, sluggish, you know, really to the point where I would want to take a nap. But knowing how good sweet potatoes are, I wanted to bring them into my life in some form. So I just started to eat them in very, very small amounts. I mean, probably starting with a half dollar size and cooking them in the steaming method to make sure that they're really soft and nice and broken down as opposed to roasting or sauteing. And over time, I mean, it took several months, mostly because I didn't want to eat them every day, but now I can tolerate sweet potatoes and I can feel their medicinal properties of being able to clear and move that maybe they weren't able to do before because of the density of the food and also where my digestive system was at that point. I don't know. I need to look at that book I really like, Healing with Whole Foods. And then there's another.
Pitchford, is that right? Pitchford is the.
And then there's another, forget his name, but if you could speak to that at all in relative to, because that the flavors, you know,
And even the Chinese, very sweet. Even the Chinese, herbal formulas are described, of course, as teas often. Mm-hmm. So again, this idea that or soup, soup. So you're creating a sense of recipe. This is not, I'll try to come back and answer your question, get a more direct question. But so the idea, this is one of the reasons that Chinese medicine or Chinese herbs are so safe as well, which I wanted to mention. Part of the beauty and efficacy of Chinese herbal medicine is that the herbs are more like foods. They're because you're using the actual substance, you're using the flower, the bark, the root. That doesn't mean that they're safe in any dosage, but they have a relatively wide therapeutic range compared to, say, pharmaceuticals, meaning it would take taking a lot of an herb most of the time, aconite being an exception to that. There are toxic herbs for sure and levels of toxicity, but basically you're using a substance in combination with other substances in its raw form. So it's like eating a lot of a vegetable, yams. For example, shan yao, Dioscorea, is a type of yam. So you're eating like a sweet potato. You're using a sweet potato medicinally with other herbs. You're cooking it. The cooking process is very detoxifying. Anyone who's traveled knows that if you want to, you know, make a good attempt at staying dysentery free, you cook your food really well. You boil it and you boil your water. So we know that cooking is a detoxifying method in and of itself. So we have this kind of beautiful tang or soup or tea that is very, very safe, in my opinion. So that's another plug. I'm going to give you another plug for herbal medicine.
Yeah, no, I think that's important because it's a question that I get, I'm sure you get, not only is what's in here, what are these, what are some side effects that I'm going to feel if you're telling me to take this dose, which seems and feels rather large. And again, that goes back to the individual too. Sometimes we do have to adjust the dose, the time of day, you know, the times that they take it a day based off of their individual constitution.
Yeah, I'm going to take issue with side effect. That's a concept I'm not very fond of. I mean, we'll call them unwanted effects.
Yeah. Good. I like that.
Right. You take pharmaceuticals and you have effects that are wanted and unwanted. Yes. Yeah. It's part of what makes assessing the safety of Chinese herbs so difficult because they're not used alone. And the substances traditionally, in terms of relationship to one another, the incompatibilities that you study for the board exams, they detoxify one another in combination. So you can have an herb that when it's combined with another herb, it minimizes these unwanted effects. Mm-hmm. And if you don't combine it may have certain qualities or characteristics that are different than you have when you're using them in a particular formula. And that's another argument that I've made for a long time, is that you can't take the herbs completely out of context. When we were talking about the Materia Medica, in that list of characteristics of herbs that's in Bensky, many of those characteristics, what we would call the actions and indications, are taken directly from their use in formulas in combination with specific other herbs. Mm-hmm. And so you would say, Bai Xiao nourishes the blood. Well, does Bai Xiao nourish the blood when it's not in combination with Dongui, for example, or does it nourish it as much? So you have these synergistic effects, you have these counterbalancing effects, you have these enhancing relationships within the formula. So there's a lot of so much elegance in that, but it makes it very difficult to bridge that gap between pharmacology and Chinese herbal medicine. Mm-hmm. Because if you take the herb out of context and you study it, then you might see, again, unwanted effects that are not present when it's combined correctly in formulas and cooked, for example.
Yeah, it's the science and the art of Chinese medicine that bring it its complexity and its mystery and its beauty.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I feel like I somehow got diverted and didn't answer at least two questions, one about bee obstruction and one more recently about the herbs. So if you want to go back to those, that's fine. And if not, that's fine too.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, what will you ask? Yeah, you might have to reframe. So you wanted to know about bee obstruction and how one would diagnose what you would call it, or how you would, I'm sorry, articulate it again, if you can. If you can't, then don't worry about it.
Yeah, I think I had two questions in there. So the first was, what would be your pattern diagnosis of that shoulder pain? And then also, we kind of talked about it, but the herbs that you would use or the flavors that you would use to then treat it, which we did that with the blood deficiency. So
of course, that would really depend on the history, the manifestation of the shoulder pain itself. So if the shoulder pain, for example, was secondary to cardiac event, that would be very different than shoulder pain that was secondary, was due to an injury in a soccer game. Very different than chronic shoulder pain that had developed over time because of a bone spur. Mm-hmm. So again, you're differentiating, right? This is the process of describing the shoulder pain. So for example, if it was due to a bone spur, I might call it bony B, which would be a little bit more of a classical diagnosis than simply B obstruction in the channel that's affected. Right? So you could say, well, it's B obstruction, meaning pain. B means painful. Mm-hmm. So painful obstruction, qi and blood are stagnating in a particular channel. So we already talked about how you can have a sinew meridian diagnosis. So if it's in this, it's at, large intestine 14, then it's going to be B obstruction in the large intestine channel. If it's maybe related to the rotator cuff and it's a bicep tendon issue, it could be related to the tai yin or the heart meridian. Not related to the heart attack or chest pain that we were discussing earlier, which is an internal medicine diagnosis that where you have shoulder pain secondary to that. So there's not, I wish I could give you a simple answer, but it would depend on what had happened. So back to my gentleman with the knee pain, right? We were able to say that was cold B in the channels that run in the yang channels, both sides, yang and yin, all the channels that run to the knees. So that would be right, the stomach channel being pretty much primary, yang would be primary. So you identify the location of the disease. Again, this is a concept that develops over time as part of your diagnosis. So B obstruction, it could describe it, the type of B obstruction. Is it bone bee? Is it cold bee? If it's swollen and red and hot, we would call that hot damp bee obstruction. If it's swollen and filled with fluid, and cold damp bee obstruction. So the languaging is as specific as you can get to both the meridian system or the channel as well as the location.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I love that you differentiated between the presentation of what the patient is experiencing, because so many people, and I know you've seen this before, they will say, oh, you gave this formula to my mom and she was having urinary continence and now I am, so can I just take the same formula?
Right.
And oftentimes, and even with shoulder stuff, I love the example of the soccer team because I see a lot of athletes. So you help one athlete and then you get another on their team with not the same injury, but something similar, and they want to do the same thing. And what I'll tell patients is you can have the same presentation, you can have the same symptoms, but oftentimes there's at least 3, if not 5, 7 different diagnoses for what you're experiencing. It's all about how it manifested and the history. And another example of that that's coming to mind is sleep. You know, there's at least 6 different diagnoses in Chinese medicine as to why people aren't sleeping.
Absolutely. And yeah, you can't a lot take, of factors, of course.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You won't be able to have the effects that you want taking the same formula that your friend took who isn't sleeping because she has a newborn child versus you not being able to sleep because of stress or worry. Mm-hmm. And we have had such a great conversation.
I glanced at the time.
I did. Well, it took, you know, they always kind of take on their own personality, which we mentioned before we started, but I'm so glad that it did. And thank you so much for being here. I'm definitely
going to have
you back. And
I would love that.
Expand and reference this episode and just be able to help patients and people to see how relatable this medicine is and how easy it is to understand. And,
it is. I wanted to end with that. I mean, I think in some ways we've had talked about some complex ideas or gone a little bit deeper than I might have expected to, but there's also this extremely basic, you know, again, Chinese medicine has this beautiful simplicity and consistency to it. Mm-hmm. The yin and the yang, mm-hmm. and the hot and the cold, and the damp and the, you know, the damp and the dry, and those you can always go back. I always encourage my students, you know, to do something simple that they understand versus doing something that someone told them to that they don't. And I think that you're a great example of how you've developed, you know, deepened your understanding so much. I haven't seen you in a while, and it's just such a joy to talk with you and see where you are in your development and your practice. And I thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you. And, you know, again, we can just go on and on, but the thing that I've learned about this medicine and being in it and is to just play and experiment and trust, you know, trust what I've learned from our elders and from the history and from the development of it. And, to just enjoy the process and how we unfold within it is just such a beautiful thing.
Right. I'm with you. Okay.
Well, thank you again.
Yes. I hope I see you soon.
We will.
Take really good care.
Thanks, Anne.
Thank you for listening to Through the Funnel. I hope you found something useful. If you have, and you like what you've heard, share around and leave a review on Apple. To get in touch, learn more about me and my classes, visit my website at sourcemedicinalarts.com. Till next time.